and welcome to episode 88 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where the small press makes one hell of a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, creator of the comic series The Red Mask from Mars, and this week I'm joined by comic artist, writer, creator, and the man behind the webcomic Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
Writer, Down the Tubes contributor, and the jam in our sandwich, Tony Esmond.
Everyone's probably pretty relieved that I wasn't that man in the Metro who got crushed by his porn collection.
Yes.
On our Facebook group, people did wonder if Tony was crushed by a huge pile of porn.
Well, Gary, my mate Gary Harding. Thank you, Gary.
It doesn't matter. Funny. He sent it into the community and it's now viral. Much like everything Tony Esmond does.
Yep.
Well, I knew Tony's gone digital years ago. He had it all scanned in.
Thank you.
I knew it wasn't him.
Yeah. Thank you, mate.
Yeah. The only thing that kill him will be the servers that fall on him.
Those hard drives.
Oh, my word. But very quietly listening to this filth is our guest this week, rounding off the posse of comics goodness. And what a gent he is for doing it. He's the artist of the hit series Amelia Cole from Monkey Brain Comics and the brilliant new series A Once and Future Queen. And he's an all-round top comics fella. It's Nick Brokenshire.
Good evening.
Hey, Nick.
Hey. You all right, Nick?
Yeah.
I like when people introduce themselves like that. It's nice.
Yeah.
I tried to keep it classy.
Oh, good.
I try, I fail.
You've listened before.
Yeah. You will be the only class thing about this episode. Let's be honest, Tony. All of our guests are the people that class up the joint.
That's true.
Yes. Recently we spoke about Once and Future Queen. I'll tell you what, I'm just going to call it Once for now. Is it The Once and Future Queen? Yeah,
it's The Once and Future Queen. Yes.
Do you have a shortened version?
Yeah, OAFQ. Wafuk.
Well, we did speak about that. Sounds like something from like a Klingon speak. Wafuk. We spoke about it recently. Dan Butcher mentioned his recommend.
It's a Glasgow thing. Get to Wafuk.
Sorry. A cracking series that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago on this very show. We were lucky enough to get a look at issue one, and we all love it, don't we?
Yes, great. Yeah,
Thank you very much.
And it's just been released this week, just gone, hasn't it? It's in comic book shops fully.
Yeah. I've double dipped on it, because that's what you call it these days, don't you? Double dipping.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it.
No, it's great, mate. Yeah, no, it's really good. Yeah, yeah.
For once, that's not an Urban Dictionary term.
I'm sure it's in there.
The comic equivalent of putting your balls in as well.
Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ.
I'm sure the PR people at Dark Horse, if they get
oh, my God. Yeah. I'm going to realise, like, every single thing that we do online and every interview and every thing that we've done, we have to CC Dark Horse in to everything. So I'm gonna have fun explaining this one.
Yeah. Well, I apologize
for the second time since you've come online.
Yeah,
Nick.
Yeah. Yeah. to be fair. Immediately you know what you're getting with this show.
I
think it's good for our American friends to hear the way we do it over in this country.
Yeah,
they got to discover a sense of humour eventually, haven't they? Are they going to need it soon, I think?
Look, the world's a crazy place, but we're not going to bring politics into this show. This is a safe haven where we're all happy. We're all about the cuddling on this show. We're all cuddling now, folks. I know some of you think that we all record in the same room, and we are this
week.
Some people
get off on it.
That's one of the lemon things that you mentioned before.
Oh my God, I might have to put in that outtake so people get that reference. Oh God. We spoke about the issue one of the series this week. So to start us off, and please get us back onto some sort of comic talking track, tell us a little bit more about the series and how it actually came to be.
Okay. How it came to be was, obviously, Adam Nave DJ Kirkbride and I had been working together for about 5 years mm-hmm. on Amelia Cole, and before that had even finished, we were, you know, we were talking about what we were going to do afterwards, and a good, I would say, a good year and a half before, you know, we were planning, we were kind of talking in very vague terms about what we'd like to do. So when Amelia Cole did finish, I went off and did, excuse me, and I've just had my tea. I went off and did another job for another writer. And then the lads came back with a, you know, like a synopsis of what we were going, what they fancied doing. And it was this Arthurian thing.
So they essentially pitched it to you, did they? They came to you?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. They obviously, they know what the kind of things that I like. I sort of do gravitate towards like mythology, and particularly British mythology, and so forth. So they'd come up with that, also based on the fact that I'd gone over to Portland to do like the Rose City Comic Con with them. And while I was over there, I you know, I really fell in love with the place. I enjoyed Portland a lot, and it reminded me quite a lot of Scotland in some ways. And so that seemed to have got their little minds ticking over, and they decided to do this thing wherein our characters would be flitting between Portland and Britain. So that kind of got their ideas flowing, and then they started throwing them to me, and slowly but surely this idea came, well, actually fastly but surely this idea came together. And next thing we know, we'd sort of done the synopsis. I'd done 2 pages of art that was very much like the art that I'm doing in the book now, as opposed to what I was doing with Amelia, and we flung that out to various editors, and Dark Horse were the ones that bit, basically.
Oh, nice.
And we were off. We were off to the races. Cool.
So you put together a whole, like, nice pitch document with...
Yeah. It was the first time I've done that, because we didn't really have to do that with Amelia. We just kind of got picked up by other people, you know? But with this one, it was the first time that we had to, like, really sit down and figure out what to say and how to say it and how to try and make it attractive, you know?
Did that take a long time? For those people out there, because I'm sure there's a lot of people that want to pitch to lots of different publishers, what did you put into your pitch document?
The actual written like synopsis was a... If I remember... Hang on, I have to think back a minute. If I remember correctly, it was like a 2-page very stripped-down explanation of what was going on in pretty much the whole story, and then I did, like, actually I did 5 pages. I did 5 different pages showcasing different types of scenes, so like battle scenes, and
so they weren't of, so they weren't sort of like in order. They were just
they were just scenes, basically, that we envisioned having to do. And because I'd kind of I'd kind of invented this approach to color that I wanted to do, then by doing these 5 different pages of different scenes, they could see what I was talking about, you know.
You use color to set scenes a lot in this, don't you?
Yeah,
like different. Yeah, it's really noticeable. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. That was something that I really wanted to to do. Right from the outset, you know.
Right. Sorry, dude, I interrupted. Yeah.
Where were we?
You were telling us how it got started. You did your 5 pages.
Yeah. This and the synopsis was really just a very straightforward explanation. You know, Rani is this person, and you know, it turns out that she's, you know, she's the one that can draw Excalibur and so on and so forth. And to be honest, like I didn't submit the pitch.
Yeah.
It was Adam and DJ that put it all together, but that was all, you know. It was just like a 2-page thing and 5 pages of art.
Right.
And that was done while you're working on another project, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we pretty much.
Are you full-time, are you, or are you full-time artist, presumably?
I am, yeah.
Because you've got to be careful about that little missing period where you haven't got any work on, so especially when this, I suppose, presumably would have been done for free, the five pages, would it, or...?
Yeah, pretty much.
An investment, I mean, yeah.
We did... I'm just trying to think back, because it's like over a year now since...
Wow. This has been in the pipeline for quite some time, isn't it, I think?
Oh, yeah. Well, I started drawing the issue that came out just now. I started drawing that on the 1st of August last year.
Right.
So, you know, that kind of shows you where we were. And obviously, like Amelia finished, I think it was March or April, and we were already in talks of how to make this thing work before that had ended. So,
And what was the book you went on to then? The sort of the one that stuck between the two projects. What was that?
That's a thing that it's a book that's been written by a chap called Ellis Bojar, who you're going to be seeing quite a bit more of in the months to come.
Right.
It's. He's this clever fella who put the word out for an artist, and our old letterer Rachel Deering put me in touch with him and said, oh, you know, this guy is looking for an artist, and so I kind of befriended this guy anyway, and we've started doing this book that is based on it's kind of like a supernatural horror thing based in the north of England.
Right.
And the way that it's worked out is I had to do the first two chapters in my little break from Adam and DJ. And then when I finish Once in Future Queen, I have to go back to Ellis and finish the book that he's been writing for another 10 months.
Right.
But it's a lot of backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
But That book is quite different in flavor. It's quite it's very slow paced and very very doom laden and that, dark.
And you're using a different kind of style for it. I'm taking. I mean, I know you said that you devised a colouring,
yeah,
a new colouring process for Wafak. but is this other one also colour? This supernatural horror.
I'm not doing any of the colour on it. I've just been doing pencils and inks. And stylistically, it's not a million miles off Once in Future Queen, but it's perhaps a little bit more realistic looking.
Right.
And also, the layout of it is a reasonably strict 9-panel grid all the way through.
Okay, interesting. Yeah,
it's got quite a constrained vibe because, like, it's a very kind of early Vertigo-esque book. So
right, that's good. Yeah,
if that gives you any idea. But that's not you're not going to see that for a couple of years, I think.
Wow. Okay.
Do you find the 9-panel pages quite constrictive? As in, there is a limited amount of stuff you can actually do with them.
yes, but. What happens is when you start working in 9-panel grid, your brain readjusts. You start seeing things in a different way, and it's kind of like
the Matrix.
It's like I don't know if you did this at high school, but did you ever do a thing where you got a piece of paper and you cut a square out of it and then you looked through it
in order
to draw something. So it was like a viewfinder, and you know, you place it on a thing and you draw what's in the square. Working with a 9-panel grid is kind of like that. You're kind of looking at the broader world and then sort of imagining you're just looking through this narrow square, and you're trying to find, you know, the perfect bit of the overall scene that you're looking at, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's how I found it anyway. It's really exciting, I find, because
Normally,
you know, when you're when you've got carte blanche on how to lay out your panels, you know, it's not that it's easy, but it's, you can just kind of cut loose with it. When you're constrained, you have to think hard, and that's quite that's quite exciting, I find.
Cool. Now, it's very similar, because obviously Watchmen is the one famous for having a 9-panel grid, isn't it? Didn't John Higgins present, they were very careful around the colours for that, weren't they? I think there was almost like a colour style thing set down at the start of that, wasn't there? Is that something you really wanted to try this time? I know you mentioned colours a minute ago. Is it, and how did you approach that?
With the Amelia Cole books, I really struggled with the colour. Well, I actually struggled with the whole book, to be honest.
Why so?
Because it was essentially the first comic I'd ever done. And like I'd done lots of strips and little, you know, short things, but I'd never, and I'd obviously done a lot of drawing and stuff, but I'd never really focused it into an ongoing thing. And the way that it worked out was, as soon as we started it, it just kind of took off like a bit of a roller coaster, and we ended up not being able to stop. And so I did a lot of learning on the fly, and that included color. If you look at the five volumes, you can kind of map what I'm learning at that given at any given time. You know, like you can see where, you know, like I'm not paying attention to certain things and looking at other things, and I'm really concentrating on backgrounds, or I'm really concentrating on this or that or whatever. It's kind of like a public university course that I did in front of everybody.
it should be, shouldn't it? You know, with everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm all right with that. But yeah. one of the things that I learned along the way was the traditional approach to color, with, you know, where you have to flat every element and then, you know, pick a color and all that sort of thing, is not my favorite thing in the world. So what I did find was that a lot of the covers that I was doing for Amelia, especially latterly, the very colorful, spattery kind of watercolory things, I enjoyed doing that. So my big thing was like, how can I make that work for interiors? And then I just kind of figured that I would, you know, go along this, you know, creating moods with single color.
Yeah. Color.
And one of the things that got me thinking in those terms was when I saw James Robinson's and I forgot the artist's name now, but
Airboy.
Yeah, because they did that, you know, where they each scene had like, you know, specific colors. That kind of inspired me, because I thought, well, that's kind of what I want to do, except that with these kind of watercolory textures, and now I've forgotten what I'm talking about.
About the use of colour.
Sorry, I'm drinking whiskey while we talk.
So. Oh my word!
Yeah. Is that allowed? Am I allowed?
Of course it is. Yeah. Greg Hinkle. Greg Hinkle is thinking of. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the colouring style. Michael K. Russell, who's been on the show before, he's put up a couple of videos recently about colouring theory, and one of those is kind of the choosing the limited colour palette and kind of off playing it against each other. And yours is a shining example of like of it in action. It's great, very sort of invocative of kind of the scenes and atmosphere within the comic. It's great.
Yeah,
thank you. I'm really glad that you say that, because like color theory is like I'm very well versed in color theory. I used to be an art teacher, so like I used to have to teach it. But then when you start trying to like really engage your brain and use color theory in a kind of what's the word, in an academic way, it's really hard. So I just found that I just tend to throw stuff at the wall and hope it looks right. But then when it came to Once and Future Queen, I didn't want to do that. I wanted it to be very, very figured out and specific. So there you go.
That's great, man. I really like it. I really like the way that you've no spoilers, but Merlin's in it, and I really like the way you've sort of treated Merlin. It's almost He's there, but the way you do it, you're not actually 100% sure he's there a lot of the time. There's almost like a ghostly colour palette to him, isn't there?
Yeah. That's connected to a plot point regarding Merlin.
Right.
It is sort of kind of covertly explained in the first issue, but okay. As time goes by, you will understand why he is that way and why he's that colour and so on.
He looks great. I don't think we're spoiling anything, but Merlin as a spaceman is just fucking brilliant. You know?
Thank you.
So kind of how much reading into the kind of Arthurian legends was done before kind of embarking on the series?
I think collectively, a lot.
Right.
I grew up as a lot of us in Britain do, you know, with the Arthurian legend. It seeps into our culture in so many ways, doesn't it?
And, yeah, definitely.
And it's in many ways, it's kind of like certainly that the post medieval British culture. It's kind of like the linchpin mythology of what we are in this country. And so the way that that's come out, I read like Le Morte d'Arthur by Thomas Malory when I was like 16, 17. I tried to, and I read other books, you know, that were based on Arthurian legend, and I saw John Boorman's Excalibur, you know, and
that movie. It's crazy good, isn't it?
I watched it again last night, you know, because I was telling my wife about it. She hadn't seen it, and I thought, oh, you've got to see this. This is one of the greatest films ever.
Seeing it at the cinema, and that bit where they ride in, and I can't remember the music that comes up, but it's so well done, you know. But it's also so fucking weird.
Yeah, that is a bonkers film.
Because they did that whole ADR thing, or you know, where they overdubbed all the dialogue.
It sounds like a foreign movie, doesn't it? If you watch it, yeah, it does. Yeah. Okay,
did that slightly influence that sort of the headpiece for Merlin?
Yes. Oh yes.
Okay. There you go.
Yeah. Oh, I can see that now. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
The other thing I like you do is I like the way you throw in little bits of hints, like the fact that she plays chess, you know, is a huge hint. And there's one panel with her just touching the top of the king on a chessboard, you know, and stuff like that. Just so well, so intelligently storytold, you know. It's just like, you don't expect that level in a book about, you know, a girl who discovers she's going to be King Arthur, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad people are picking up on it.
Well, I mean, you get a lot of reimaginings of like famous sort of legends or folklore or whatever, and some of them can be so cookie cutter and don't pay attention to that kind of
You
know, they don't give it layers. It's just, oh, here's a Nickelodeon version. I mean, that's a bit harsh.
Yeah.
Nickelodeon,
yeah.
But you know what I mean.
Here's a Xenoscope version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot going on in this series, isn't there? I mean, in terms of like characters and like character designs and what you're going to do with them, was it a big group effort?
Definitely. I found that Adam and DJ, they obviously have a really great relationship with regards to, you know, inventing stuff. But I've kind of figured out, I have to run this past them actually, but I figured out that they take things that I say, because we're pretty good friends now, and they take things that I say and just nonsense that I talk, and they go off and do stuff with it, you know? Like they'll come back to me and say, how about this? And it's kind of weirdly based on some crap that I said. combined with their clever ideas, you know.
So
I think the point of that is that they've got to know me so well that they can go away and kind of parse through my mad ravings and kind of go, oh, this is what he's into, and then come back with a story, you know. And I think all good writers do that. But,
yeah, that's good. I like the way you gave her a kilt as well.
Oh yeah, that's a reference to Clueless.
Okay. I didn't know. I wasn't expecting that.
Well, obviously the Scottish thing, but I really love that film, Clueless.
Yeah,
so, so I thought I'm going to stick a kilt on her.
Yeah,
good man.
It is a classic. It is a classic. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, man's in it, so that's all by me.
A lot has been said about like the changing of characters and stuff. So tell us a bit more about like the, you know, the basis behind like the changing of the gender of like King Arthur, for instance. You know, the thought process that went behind it, rather than, because it's clearly more than just, you know, here's a PR stunt. You know, it's more
than a gender flip, which is it seems to be what people go to occasionally, don't they? Yeah. See, this is better than that. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did all that come about and those sort of ideas?
Well, for me personally, like I've said this in a couple of interviews, and it sounds kind of flippant, but I really kind of mean it, and that is that we've basically seen every permutation of the male hero. You know, we've seen it all. We've seen it from Luke Skywalker to Beowulf. You know, King Arthur. Die Hard, everything. We've seen it all, and every piece of grey, you know, in between, from white to black. But we haven't seen every permutation of female heroes. We've seen a lot, obviously. We saw some crackers in the 80s, but I just feel, for me personally, I want to see more. You know, I want to see lots of all the little subtle things that we've not yet seen from female heroes. And I feel that, you know, the Arthurian legend is such a rich source of stories and so on, that, you know, it seems kind of natural to want to try out with a female. And so, like, when I say an interview... obviously. But yeah, that's my basic idea, and I think as well, like Adam and DJ, they, you know, they have their reasons. DJ often quotes the fact that he really respects his mum, and his mum is a big inspiration, and so, you know, he feels that he wants to explore that sort of thing, and that's cool. But for me, it's all down to, I just want to see what a girl would do in this situation, because I know what blokes would do. You know?
Right,
and that's all. That's as simple as it is for me.
Okay, yeah. Have you caught any flack for it, Nick? Or, you know, is something you've had any shit for? Because I know sometimes it's done thoughtlessly for, you know, inches on Bleeding Cool or something, isn't it? You know, and I'm certainly not saying it about this case, but I just wonder whether anyone had seen it as that. You know,
I've not seen that as of yet.
Right.
I've read a few reviews, and on the whole, they're, you know, I think they're actually quite fair. But there's been a couple where the people have clearly kind of not really got what we're going on about, and that's okay. But I've not really had any, I've not had any negative stuff. The weird thing is when we started Amelia, that was before the whole, I don't know if you recall that, like, around 2012, it was just after 2012, the whole women in comics thing really, really exploded.
Like, right,
it was a really massive thing. And then very, very soon after that, we had our Kelly Sues and so on, you know, coming, you know, bursting out of the gate with their amazing work. It feels like in the past 5, 6, 7 years, you know, things have changed quite a lot, and we started Amelia at that time with a very specific idea of, like, hey, you know, it's time for women, you know, to get front and center in some of these stories. So it was kind of more of a political move in those days for us, whereas in this situation, in Once a Future Queen, it's more just like, I just want to see what would happen, you know?
Yeah, it's where the story takes you. Yeah, which is the best way to do it, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know that there are companies out there, we won't name them, who have just decided that Robin Hood's a girl, or you know that this sort of thing. I think Xenoscope did a sort of sexy female Robin Hood, didn't they? You know?
Yeah.
But this is not that at all, is it? You know.
Yeah.
I think it's weird. Like, I'm certainly not bad-mouthing anyone, but like with Marvel and stuff, they've kind of really gone into that a lot, haven't they? Like,
Thor
and so on and so forth, and that's fine. And I think the main reason is it's just because I want to see, because we all want to see what would happen if Thor was a woman. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
because we know what he does when he's a bloke. He walks in and says, "I want a horse." You know,
matter what people say, it's the second week in a row we've talked about the female Thor, but you know, people can say whatever they want with that sort of story, but Tony will probably correct me on this, but there isn't many times you've had a female sort of Thor sort of storyline as such a focus. Has that happened before, Tony?
Well, there's been a few what ifs, and you've obviously got the Valkyrie character who is essentially
what ifs, I mean, they're great, but you can essentially dismiss them in terms of like the massive
continuity. You can. Yeah. I mean, there's some what ifs that are incredibly well done. That's why they were there. You know, what you wanted to see.
The only thing I kind of question that strategy is during the week, someone posted up a panel from, I think it was a Wolverine comic, and had the X-23 character, and they were sort of making reference to, oh, the only people that won't like it is like guys on the internet. And so I don't understand why Marvel's sort of its fan base seems to be a little salty at the moment. And they're kind of prodding them.
Yeah, you know, like, I think the problem is people complain about that, don't read Marvel comics. They don't appreciate that Logan is in Marvel comics at the moment. He's got his own comic, Old Man Logan. You know, and it's been going 20 issues now. You know, people go on about it and they go, oh, you know, it's just a film. Well, he is in the comic, so, you know.
Yeah. I just kind of like when the readership at the moment seems to be kind of, it's going through this kind of weird phase. Just to kind of, you know, like George Lucas, when he got all the flack from the Phantom Menace about Jar Jar Binks, there's a scene in Attack of the Clones where Jar Jar Binks walks center frame and just looks straight at the camera. Yeah. And it's like, why have you done that?
Yeah, I love that, though.
It's just the kind of like...
Who's Jar Jar Binks?
Oh, God. We're not getting into that debate.
No.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's not done well enough. I think sometimes it's... And I can see why people, you know, have followed a character for, you know, in some cases 60 years, you know, and it's just taken away from them. I can appreciate why that is, why people don't like it, you know. I think that characters generally come back. Logan's been gone now a couple of Wolverine. Logan has Wolverine for a couple of years. I don't know. Thor is in his own comic now, isn't he?
Yeah.
So.
But they all come back. I mean, invariably, you'll end up coming full circle. And
there's this conspiracy theory that they're all going to be coming back, you know, with a bit of a reworking that's coming up, aren't they?
Well, that'll always happen. But
I sort of view it more from a financial point of view, though. If you've got Captain America and all these characters in your movies, they should be front and centre in your comics.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I think. I think with the falling sales of comics now, you know, and some of them aren't selling very well, some of them sell okay, but, you know, You need to have that. If as a kid, you know, if I saw, you know, the Wolverine movie, I'd want to go in and buy the Wolverine comic.
Yeah.
Do you think? Can I interrupt?
Yeah, we'll see.
Sure.
Do you think that the companies that like Marvel and DC have just decided? Look, you know, it's those 40-year-old dudes. They're the ones that buy the comics. And that seems to be the end of the story there. So we're going to draw from the history of those comics and create, you know, these wonderful movies. But as far as the comics are concerned, we're just going to make them for them and anyone else who happens to come along, but mainly for them. Have they made that decision? Because like it feels that way to a certain extent.
Yeah, it's difficult because if you've got a readership and you say, right, we want to capitalize and get another readership in, you've got the tricky task of appealing to one audience that's not involved in the project and then not alienate one that's already there. And sometimes I've kind of seen some of the stuff that Marvel do, and I can't comment too much on the comics, but it feels like they're going too much for a new audience and then alienate some of the older ones.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to I hate to think this, and I don't know at all, but I don't know whether they do know what they're doing. I think we see it as this big sort of editorial drive to do this thing or that thing. But if you look at Deadpool, there's what, 6 Deadpool comics a month, and they all have the same mood and vibe as the movie. And I think that, you know, and there can only be 6 Deadpool comics a month if they're selling, presumably.
Yeah.
You know, and they must be collecting new readers because of that. So why they're not doing an Avengers book that's got the Hulk and Thor and Black, you know, and, you know, doing that with all the classic characters, you know, and running that through the continuity. I don't know why they don't do that. I think it's too fractured, I think.
Yeah. I think with, certainly, and this is the social media generation, everyone's got a shorter attention span as well. So you have all of these, like, Gwenpools and all of this. And sorry to anyone who likes these characters. But whenever I see those, it feels like they're making the most of like the one hit wonder. Do you know what I mean? Like that's popular at the moment. Let's have a month where that's on everything, and then you won't see it again.
Yeah, it's almost like a desperation for sales. Suddenly, right? This will work for 2 months, or this will work for 3 months. You know, let's get some big sales numbers on, and then it will drop off. But I don't know.
One of those things he Pat Mills mentioned when he spoke to him was the fact that when he was running 2000 AD, his stories would very much be looking at what was going on and what was popular and bringing out product that would cash in on that. Do you know what I mean? Like they would see something on TV and there'd be a TV series or a craze that kids would love. That's right, the kids love yo-yos, right? Let's have a character or a story about yo-yos.
The yo-yo, yeah.
And then that would kind of do well, and perhaps you got a bit more reaction in that regards. I don't know.
I mean, there's a balance, isn't it? I mean, I admire you 100% if you do a comic that is completely original and it doesn't hark back to anything else that's going on. It may not sell very well, depending on how well it's done or whatever, how well it's publicised. But I think comics have to be commercial for the industry to survive. And I think that's what Pat gave me some feedback on a comic today, actually. And he said, look, I really like this part of it. It's very commercial sounding and should sell well. And from Pat, that's a huge compliment, you know. And that's how we should be seeing it. We shouldn't be seeing, oh, this all, you know, this can pander to this crowd and this can pander to this crowd. It should be, what do people want to read? What does the new reader want to walk in a comic shop and read?
Yeah.
You know, and I think, and taking it back to Nick's book here, you walk in here, you know, we hear about, you know, and we see it, that girls buy more and more comics. A teenage girl walks into a comic shop and sees this, they're going to love it. You know, this is a comic that speaks to them and should be popular for that reason.
Yeah.
You know. Oh, well.
Ran over. There's a lady I work with who reads comics. I essentially say, check this one out. And I handed over like the Once in Future Quinn because I did a print out of it because I hate reading digitally. And she read this out. And she said, I said, it's going to be out like next week or so. And she said, I have to go and get that one then. She said, have you got any more? I was like, no, you have to buy it.
Selling comics one person at a time.
Dan Butcher's like Del Boy. He's just there. Yeah.
It cost him £40 to print it out.
It cost the company, Tony, not me. Usually I always kind of, if I get a comic, or I sort of say, oh, look, check this out, and then they go off and buy it. So, you know what I mean? I don't mind doing cool. that. Yeah.
So basically, if I just email you with every comic that I make, and then you can print it out and get it out to your office, and we're sorted. And then,
you get a couple of copies in the sales, or they're going to buy straight away.
Love it.
I was going to ask you a bit about the publicity machine. Seems like a good time. So, how did you find it? Monkey Brain is it Chris Robeson runs Monkey Brain? Is it? I'm trying to think.
Yes, Chris and Allison, his wife Allison. They started it. Monkey Brain used to be Chris's publishing imprint for his prose books.
Oh, okay.
And so basically, they just used the same name because they decided that they wanted to make this imprint for comics, where the creators had complete control over their creations. And they run it. It's a weird thing. It sort of runs itself. Like Adam, Adam Nave, one of the writers, he kind of helped them set up their websites and their basic infrastructure. And I don't really know any more about that. But I think it's probably wound down a fair bit now because times have changed. it's been a few years now. It was a good time for that to happen because it was at the same time as iPads were, you know, coming into their own.
Yeah.
And the whole digital thing really exploded from 2012 onwards.
Yeah.
And we were there, you know, right at the beginning. So
yeah.
Those are like sort of like Monkey Brain and Action Lab. They're another one that I see a lot on Comixology as well.
Yeah,
there was a real boom period of these like small little pocket companies that were just putting out quality product as well. That's the thing, is it's not like everyone was just growing out of the ground. You know, there was some great comics coming out from these, and they still are. But I think you have that sort of the initial sort of launch period, which is the same for any comic, really, isn't it? You know, the first issue is always the massive, you know, everyone's talking about it, and then you hit that steady sort of plateau, and you want the plateau to be as positive as you can be, really.
Yeah. It was an interesting thing with Amelia because because it was such a long series, it was so kind of ongoing that we had to keep finding new ways. Well, kind of try to find new ways.
Publicity spikes, sort of thing. You mean?
Yeah. To get people back in. And to be honest, the real key to that was Comixology, because they would allow us to do these little sales and things, you know. So like, you know, whenever there was a new trade or whatever, they would, you know, do all the issues for super cheap so that everyone would just buy everything. Just to draw attention to us, you know. And that kept us going. And then of course when IDW picked us up, that was another, you know, thing that would draw attention.
As I understand it, IDW get first option on Monkey Brain books. Is that the deal, is it, I think, as I understand it? It's for print copies of them. Is that right?
No, it was more. Oh, okay. It was more. The connection with IDW was because Alison Baker, Chris's wife, Chris Robertson's wife, and also, you know, boss of Monkey Brain, she started to work for IDW. So,
oh, okay.
So she introduced some of the creators from Monkey Brain to IDW, and then they just left us to it. So they didn't sort of say, you know, you've got to go with IDW. It was basically, it was like, you know, Nick, Adam, DJ, this is IDW, and then let us talk, and we thrashed out a deal. Because, like, I think, was it Bandette that came out on Dark Horse? So they just, you know, they found their own deal for print stuff. It's just that because we were a bunch of nobodies, you know what I mean? It was kind of, we still are, and the fact that someone would say, hey, look, IDW is willing to even speak to you, it was like, okay, that's fine, let's do it, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why that happened. But the connection is Alison, really.
Oh, okay. So how did you find the difference with Dark Horse? Because I mean, about 3 or 4 weeks before the release, I walked into Orbital, which is my shop, and they've got postcards. Dark Horse have put out a load of postcards for it.
Oh,
did you find that much more organised, or organised in a different way, put it that way?
Well, I sent those postcards, actually.
Oh, did you? Okay.
I did a lot of ringing around shops, including Orbital, and just saying, will you please put our comic, you know, on your wall or something? I at that time, like a few weeks back, I thought, oh, they're not going to do anything, you know, they're just going to let us, you know, do it ourselves. And then, like, you know, as the release date started getting closer, they just kind of kicked into gear, you know, and started getting it out, and all of a sudden we were, you know, really highlighted in previews and blah blah blah. So like, you know, Dark Horse pushed us more than IDW, but that was mainly, I think, because IDW kind of weirdly inherited us, as opposed to put money into us. They didn't really put that much money into us, other than printing the books.
Yeah, the product was there already, wasn't it? Mm. Presumably, yeah. Unlike the Once and Future, which is, it will be there. You know, they're taking an investment, I suppose, in you, are they? Or
yeah, well, you know, they paid for us to do the book, so
yeah,
it's obviously in their interest to try and make it work. You know,
so I understand it. Dark Horse give you a page rate. So it's a page rate because they're your publisher. I don't think Image do that. Do Image pay you on the book when it's done? I'm not sure. Do you
I
know?
Think, I think Image. I think you, from what I've heard from other podcasts and stuff, I think you create the book essentially, and then it's in Image's hands, and they'll do the printing and, like, you know, all of that jazz. But it very much is your bag, I think.
The Dark Horse are a page rate, are they? Or?
Yeah, well, sort of.
Right.
To be honest, every company kind of has quite a flexible approach to how they do deals. It is literally about striking up deals. So, if Hickman goes to, you know, to Image and says, "I want to do a book," that they will probably say, "Okay, well, you know, here's some money, blah blah blah, and this will keep you going. You do it." Whereas, like, for lower on the rung type people, you kind of have to get it going on your own bat and so on and so forth. Like, different people get different deals, you know.
Okay, okay, yeah.
And that's why you see a lot of the people from the bigger companies, isn't it? They go to Image, and because they have built up that name, they have got that sort of, not a legacy, but they've got the reputation, you know.
Right.
You know, Image just sort of say, well, that person's got a following, let's put out their book.
Yeah.
Right, and so they'll be willing to, you know, to put a little bit of money up front, you know, for that person.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
But at the same time, so, like, those creators, they've still put the time in. You know, it's not like they use some of these big publishers just to get the Image deal. I mean, a lot of the time you see them, they're both doing two at the same time, isn't it? You know, they don't shortchange their big, you know, the big two job just for the Image job. Does that make sense? You know, someone like Jonathan Hickman, he was doing for a long time. He was doing Secret Wars, and what was it? His Image books, Tony, East or West.
East West, and he did the Nightly News before that, though, didn't he?
Yeah.
What
was the science one? Oh God.
With the almost sort of comedic one.
Yeah.
The Manhattan Project or something like that.
That was it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I think it's easier for a writer because you can be writing four or five books at a time, can't you? Yeah. So you've got the money coming in from Marvel, and you can go off and do a project for, you know, self-published or an Image book, you know, without that payment up front. But as an artist, you're almost working to work, aren't you? So you need to keep working. So it must be a difficult decision to say, right, I'm going to do this Image book. I'm not going to get paid for 4 months, you know, I suppose. It's a funny way to live in it almost. You know?
Yeah.
So how long ago did you give up your day job, Nick?
Let's see. It's about a year and a half.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was as a teacher, was it? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a high school teacher.
Have you always been a comic fan, or?
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. I grew up on, like, 2000 AD, obviously, and like the 80s reboot of The Eagle. I was a massive fan of that.
Okay. Mm. Right.
And mainly because of what's his name? What's the artist guy, the guy that did Dan Dare?
Not Bilardelli, no.
No, Ian Kennedy. That's
okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Not was that Kansas. When Dan Dare was blonde? Was that the blonde Dan Dare?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I remember that. He looked like Roy the Rovers in space.
Yeah. People are up in arms. Yeah,
that
Terry
D. Blonde.
Yeah,
that artwork was beautiful, though. It was really lovely. Yeah. So I grew up on that stuff, and then, like, when I was 16, my school was throwing away a bunch of books, and I got three books out of the bin, and one was. Right. One was Arzak by Moebius.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
One was Lone Sloan Delirious by Dreyer.
Okay.
And the other one was, like, The Making of Alien.
Oh, cool. And, you had a progressive school.
Yeah, great books.
Yeah, well, I don't know why they had them in the first place, but they decided they didn't want them anymore, so I took them home and...
There's probably a boner somewhere in the background or something, wasn't there? Yeah. Well, they realised after having it on the shelf for 4 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking art-wise, is you when you said pen and ink, presumably you're still traditional, then, or you coloring digitally?
Yeah, yeah, I do the pages traditionally, and then, well, the colours are actually a bit of a mixture. What I do is I create like textural backgrounds using watercolours on paper.
Oh wow! Okay.
And then I drop those in and behind like the inks, and then all the color of like the foreground stuff and all the highlights and low and shadows I paint with a digital watercolor.
Okay.
Okay.
Which is why it's kind of got that blobby quality.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the skylines. You can definitely see that. Yeah, there's a sunset or a sunrise. Sunset, I think.
Yeah, I love that sunset. See that. That's a beautiful sunset. The colors on that are wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Reminds me of Dean Beattie, who does random trials, and kind of he does the draw it in hand, then print it in Photoshop, print it out, colour it, put it back in Photoshop, and adds like so many layers to it. Mm. And it really kind of brings the artwork to life.
So you went to the same school of masochism that Dean went to, clearly.
Yeah, it's just called being an artist. If you want a hard life, be an artist.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Or come on this podcast. There are two things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So kind of page-wise, how long will it take you to turn a page around?
It takes me a day to pencil and ink a page.
Okay.
That's cracking, because you're not exactly someone who skimps on detail or backgrounds.
Yeah. A lot of it is tricks, though, you know, like it's not tricks, you find a rhythm, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When it comes to drawing stuff. And this one I've not had, like, even though a lot of the backgrounds look kind of complex, they're not actually that bad. Like, I've not had to do too many cityscapes in this one yet.
Right.
But that's
a few troll armies, though, haven't you? Well, don't call them trolls. Sorry, pardon me. You've got a few of them coming up, as I understand it, haven't you?
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of punch ups coming up with with these creatures.
Yeah, because you've only just sort of touched on the action, really, haven't you? Like as it gets on. So as the story goes on, there's five issues. Are there some how? Big action scenes, you know, how do you feel about action scenes in general?
I'm actually quite nervous about them because actual physical violence is something that I haven't really done before.
Wait a minute, you're Scottish.
I mean, drawn. I mean, obviously. It's just something that I grew up with. I'm from Aberdeen, you know. But no, like drawing people punching and cutting each other is something that I've not done much of. It's always been people shooting each other with magical stuff, and so it's kind of new to me. And like the stuff that's coming up, there's a lot of it, you know. So I'm kind of slightly worried about it, but I'm just gonna give it my best shot, you know.
I think those sort of pages can provide like the proudest moments, though, isn't it? When you look at a script and you think, "How the hell am I going to do this?" And you know, if you manage to achieve it, and it's got and the page isn't static and it sort of comes alive, you know.
Put some stuff up on Facebook that's looking pretty immense. I've got to tell you, dude. Yeah, it's looking great.
Mm.
Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I try and kind of. I'm trying to kind of document just about everything that I do, whether it be a scribble or or whatever. Just get it there, you know. I don't know why.
Do you find you have to have that social media momentum? Have you come up against any of that yet? You know, if you don't post a picture for 2 days, people think you're working on something secret, or you're not working, or you know, your editor rings you and go, "What was that with you then?" You know, is there a bit of that goes on, do you think?
I think that goes on more in my head than it does in real life. I do think that it correlates to the kind of interest that I'll get on, say, Twitter and Instagram. So, like, if I you know, put a picture out every day, then I will get a new addition to Twitter and Instagram. And even though I'm not completely sure how that translates into sales or anything, I just don't know what that means. But I just want to want to keep people aware of what I'm doing, because it's the only thing I can think of to do, really, that will help people find the books.
It's a strange world like that now, isn't it? I know Lambo was I was talking to Lambo about this, and he was saying that he's obviously got a bit of a secret project on the go, and he can't put a lot of it out there,
right?
You know. And people are saying to him, you know, what are you up to these days? You know, and he said, well, I'm working on a secret project. I can't really put it out there, you know.
In theory, I should just get up in the morning and then start drawing this book. But what I've found is because I can't show anything, I can't really show anything of real importance from the book, then I feel that I better go and do a warm-up sketch of something that is mildly interesting, of something completely different. That I can then put out there, just so that people don't forget that I'm me. And
people do that, don't they? That's quite common, isn't it, I think, now? Yeah, look, people often give a shout-out, don't they? What do you think I should do for a warm-up sketch and stuff like that?
Yeah. It's a good idea.
Yeah, definitely.
I did
one
of Lobo, just like on a scrap of paper, and tweeted that, and it got loads of likes, and it's like, that's the first time I've ever drawn that character and ever thought about drawing it, and... Mm. It wasn't a thing I was going to try and do. Do you know what I mean?
Just, you do a great Lobo, I've got to tell you.
It's like, here's a doodle of Lobo.
Everyone loves Lobo, though, don't they?
Vince.
Oh, God.
I'm always the odd one out.
If you read the Legion stuff, the L-E, you know, G-I-O-N, not the Legion superhero stuff with Lobo in and Amiga Men and stuff like that, that's some great stuff. Yeah, I think when he went a bit crazy, you know, at one point.
Yeah, Dan Wright is a good character.
Yeah.
Well, you could argue that any character is a good character if they're done right.
You could argue
that. God, Professor Hunt here, look.
Oh, dear.
I was saying, quickly bring it up, the character Dan Wright. I went to see Logan today, and I really enjoyed it. I know we said we weren't going to talk about it, but yeah, it's a great film. I'd check that out. It's really well done.
Agreed. We can't talk about it because Vince ain't seen it yet, have you, Vince? So
yeah.
No, I haven't.
Careful.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll see it this week?
I probably will, yeah. I think I might have to double bill it, that and the new King Kong film.
I want to see that as well, yeah.
That looks like a good cinema film.
I saw Logan in IMAX actually, but I think I'd probably rather see King Kong on the IMAX.
Are they gearing up for King Kong to fight Godzilla?
Yeah,
is that
that's coming in a couple of years?
Really?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Because in the trailer they're sort of flying around him, shooting at him with machine guns from a helicopter, and I thought, this is not a great idea. I mean, if I saw like a 60-foot tall gorilla,
don't give me that, Dan. You'd be going at it with a gun. Yeah. You'd be like, come on,
have a pen knife. Go, let's have it.
Just parachuting out of the helicopter right into its face.
Yeah. There's got to be room for a commission for Red Mask meets King Kong, surely, isn't there?
Yeah.
Well, there's room for any commissions if people want.
Right, too.
A kind of good shot of King Kong with his mouth wide open with his hand. Right, cut up to the foreground, the viewer, and just releasing Red Mask into his gaping maw. That'd be good.
Hang on, are you saying King Kong would beat Red Mask? I'm taking umbrage with this, Dan.
Well, perhaps he can beat him from within, the classic get eaten, and then
he'd make him cry if you ask me.
Oh dear, every week I feel like I'm beating from within.
Yeah, beating off.
Oh!
Got to that bit.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the comic, Nick. It's been released this week. How, obviously you were quite nervous, I take it, leading up to the launch.
Wrapping it.
No need to be, mate. It's a great book. Everyone says that. Everyone who does a great book seems to come on here and is all nervous about it. Yeah, and then no, this is a great book. Really good.
Oh.
First Dark Horse book I bought in a single issue for a while, actually.
Really? I have to say, I got such a thrill when we landed this deal, because Dark Horse means quite a lot to me personally. I grew up you know, in the 80s and 90s, and Dark Horse put out a lot of the stuff that blew my mind back in the day, you know, Sin City and all
the
that
Alien
sort of
Predator books were great, and obviously stuff like Black Hammer
Sin
and all
City.
The
Sin City,
the Big Nugget stuff.
They had like what was it, X, they did that whole universe, Ghost. Didn't they, was it the World's Greatest Heroes or something, that had like barbed wire and ghosts.
Dark Horse Presents put out some amazing fucking stuff.
And Concrete was on Dark
Horse.
Really good.
Wasn't Cerebus with Dark Horse at one point?
No, Dark Anaheim. Which I read Cerebus from Hell this week, mate. That's fucking the most, one of the most mental things I've ever read.
Well, that's saying one something thing. You know, he's read people.
I've just clocked when I've read the Once a Future Queen, I can't remember the acronym we was calling it now, but obviously she's a chess champion, and presumably the queen piece is a lot more powerful in chess than the king piece. That'd be a nice kind of, presumably the writers have thought ahead and kind of tackled that, but it's a really nice little
It's a nice thing. Bridge, isn't it?
The idea is that basically Arthur was like a placeholder for for her, and for the true Arthur, and for the true king. And so, you know, she's the queen, so she's more powerful than the king.
Oh, nice one.
And you know she's the queen because she's got queen hair.
Because I'm trying to remember in the tales, Arthur sort of he dies, and they said he'll come back when
England's in need or something. Is it?
Yeah. He gets kind of pushed off to Avalon. Is that correct? Is that right?
That's one of the things. I don't think that we sort of tie in specifically to that in our particular version. You know, Merlin kind of explains that, you know, he was it. I don't want to say too much because this is basically, you know, Arthur was there, but she's the true Arthur. And so that you know, because her name is Rani Arturus, and Rani means queen and I don't know if it's Gujarati, but one of the Indian
lands. Okay.
So basically the stars aligned for her. She's the actual real deal.
Go on, mate, sorry.
Go on. You go for it, Tony.
I was going to say, is there actually an Excalibur Comics in Portland?
There is, yes.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at the Excalibur Comics bag as we speak. They asked, you know, could we be in it? So
we started.
Well spotted, by the way. That's really tiny on the page.
Page one. Yeah. Okay.
Nothing gets past Tony Esmond.
You did a signing this weekend as well, did you? How did that go?
Great. Yeah. Yesterday at Travelling Man in Manchester with Adam Cadwell and Mark Penman.
Adam's a friend of the show. I think we've interviewed him for one of the convention specials. Yeah, and obviously Rachel's been on.
He's a gentleman. He really is.
He's good agony.
Very much so. I've known him for years, but not very well. You know, he's one of those guys that, you know, if you're in the UK scene, you'll obviously know that he's there because he's
a bubble.
But I actually got to, you know, spend a bit of time with him yesterday, and it was lovely. Finally got all the books, you know.
Yeah.
And so I'm reading through Blood Blokes now.
Oh,
that's good. Yeah, very good. Yeah. Did it go well? How were people? How was the reception around the book?
It was good. It was steady. It was a steady stream of people. It wasn't, it wasn't like when Mike Mignola turned up. But
One day, Nick.
Yeah. Wow. Can you imagine? It was lovely, and. It's nice to be able to explain the comic to people, and people go, oh, you know, that's kind of fun. My sales pitch, my missus hates this, but my sales pitch is, I say, you know King Arthur, and people go, yes, And then I'll say, well, she's King Arthur. And then they go, ooh. that's how it happens in my head anyway.
Yeah.
So but what does your wife say when you do that?
She just thinks I'm ridiculous.
Is she a comics reader?
She actually generally no, but she sat down and read something like 70 issues of Walking Dead over one weekend. She just she decided she liked it, so she just hammered it, and that's how she works. She just will sit down, and if something tickles her fancy, she'll tickle it right back.
That's the sort of series that it is easy to just sort of just fly through, isn't it? It's an easy read, The Walking Dead, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Not easy like when you see like people that you love getting their head smashed in.
Yeah,
you know, if you read The Walking Dead, you've got
I interrupt you again, Vince. Sorry, go on.
No, you can go, Dan.
We had a guest on recently who had just done the same thing.
Yeah,
read for a shitload of Walking Dead. Was it Jay Gunn?
I can't remember now. I must catch up. Actually, I'm about four or five volumes behind. I usually read it with my son because we both like enjoy reading it, but we need to catch up, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's well made.
It was the only sort of, when I cut back on a lot of like monthly comics, it was one of the only ones that was regular every month I was getting.
Okay. Are you still reading it monthly, are you? Or?
No. Well, you know, I'm spending my money on like the indies and stuff like that now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, okay.
Talking of Image, there was that thing this week with Robert Kirkman.
Oh, yes.
He brought up. That wasn't a segue. I wasn't trying to segue there, but he said essentially, didn't he say that with Walking Dead, if it wasn't published at Image, say it was published at Valiant or Boom, he said we wouldn't be talking about it now.
Yeah.
I'm not sure to say about that.
No, he loves a shock, though, doesn't he? He loves a bit of shock value, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I think he knows what he's saying most of the time. Whether you agree with it or not, obviously, you know, as he's gotten bigger as a creator, you always have those more people are out to just sort of have a go at you, aren't they? But now he's so successful, he doesn't give a fuck.
I wonder how in context it was as well. It's one line out of a whole talk, like, really.
And it was talking about Image. It was the Image sort of yearly sort of celebration type thing, wasn't it? If I remember correctly. So they were talking about. I think Liefeld was there as well, wasn't he?
There was everyone but Jim Lee there, I think, from the original creators, wasn't he? I think. Yeah.
I mean,
you know, he's going to shit talk Image, are you?
Yeah, this place is bullshit. But I do. I think it's an interesting topic of discussion because you can't necessarily disagree with him.
No.
Because it has been so huge, and I think being at Image has helped that.
I mean, I think it helped Image a lot as well.
I mean, I would say Image wouldn't be in the sort of position they are now if it wasn't for The Walking Dead's steady sort of colossal sort of top 10 list. It stayed there. It was number one for a long time, wasn't it, if I remember correctly?
It's done really well for them, isn't it? And the revenue from the TV series can't be hurting anyone's pockets, I suppose.
But obviously, when you read an article when someone's sort of saying, "Oh, if this wasn't, if this was published at Valiant, it wouldn't have been as popular," or such and such. And when you read something that's out of context, it can seem a bit more negative than it is. So I'm hesitant to say to sort of judge it too much, but at the same time, I'm guilty of when I read it, I thought, "Hang on, pal, that's a bit out of order." Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah,
they did mention some numbers of Valiant, and I was shocked, if I'm honest.
I can't remember
what the numbers were, but I was like,
I listened to a podcast that's the Valiant podcast. I think it's kind of sponsored a bit by them because that is it. Dinesh Shamdasani, he goes on there quite a lot, and they'd been privy to some sales figures, and they were saying their lower titles were about 3,500, their upper titles about 8,500 currently. And I thought, that is not much at all. The days gone by where even a Vertigo book allegedly would have been cancelled if it sold less than 10,000. You know, and they're making such great books as well.
Hmm. You know, we're certainly in the day and age where if any of the big two books were in that sort of number, they wouldn't be long for this world, would they?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what the trade sales are, and I think it's probably some business model around the trades. Yeah. You know,
certainly. I'm guilty. You know, with Valiant, I'm going to get all the trades. Do you know what I mean? So I'm guilty of not buying the monthly issues.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm still going to put money in their pockets because their trades are fucking magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care about sales numbers. The only thing that worries me is that a book will go away.
Yeah,
that's always my only concern.
Yeah,
is it something that you hear about at all, Nick, or are you like looking at your phone every 5 minutes to see how the sales going or anything like that?
No. I'm keeping away from that at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Right, you don't need that stress, do you?
No.
I mean, your book is a nice 5-issue arc, though, isn't it? So you can tell your story.
Yeah.
Nice little trade. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to keep it as sort of low key as possible as far as any of that kind of stuff is concerned. Because
you got enough work to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh gosh, I think if I started worrying about numbers, I'd.
Yeah,
have a breakdown.
Yeah. Well, I'm sitting pretty on my Comixology money coming in, so that's got me sorted.
How many bags of crisps can you get this month, Dan? Is it two? Are you going to get salt and vinegar and cheese and onion this month?
Well, it's a quarter. It's like I nearly could afford a pint this quarter.
Oh, I'm doing it. Living the dream.
Yeah, killing it.
Digital comics.
Yeah. it's kind of a global trend. Is comics generally year on year falling? I mean,
it has little ups and downs, doesn't it? I think we get peaks and troughs, don't we? I mean, if you want to compare it against, you know, a certain year, then it probably they don't sell very well. But I think, aren't they doing better than last year, as I understand it? Is that right?
I don't know.
But that's the society we live in. I had to see it. There was some fucking, there's about 45 posts in my Twitter stream today about how well Wolverine the movie did, and you know, its opening is better than, it's the best R-rated movie opening in March, you know, since this year. And I'm like, really?
Now they're being specific about, it's the best opening on this particular day at this particular minute since last week when that minute was, and it's just pointless.
Everything
now
has to be a record breaker now, don't they?
The way I see it is, look, the comics are definitely, I don't think we're ever going to get back to, you know, that moment in the late 80s, early 90s when comics was king, you know. I just don't think it's possible because of the way, you know, new media works. Yeah. But one thing I do know is that it is an art form that people will all, that there will always be a subset of people that love it. Yeah. So whether there are a billion people making it or just a handful of people making it, selling it to just a handful of people, I know that it's going to keep going. And I know the fact that I'm going to be one of those people, you know?
Awesome.
Good man.
So that, you know what I mean? So
Yeah.
I think worrying about like the overall effect of you know, movies on comics and stuff is kind of like leading us nowhere. Yeah. The important thing is, let's just make comics, you know.
We live in such a minute to minute society that there's quite, and it's so sort of headline based that you almost think that everything has to be the best so far.
Right.
And as long as a comic makes enough to make another comic, that's all I'm interested in, really. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're Marvel and DC, then okay, you want to shift a certain amount of, you know, comics.
Yeah.
But for the rest of us, we just want to tell stories, whether it be to 10 people or 5 million people, you know.
Yeah.
As long as I get the opportunity to show my stories to a few people, then I've achieved what I want to achieve, you know.
I think the benefit with your book as well, Nick, is it will make a lovely trade, you know, a contained story that people want to pick up. I can see it being on the shelves for a few years. You know, it's not like it's going to be, you know, trade 5 of the Avengers or, you know, whatever it's going to be. This is a nice little self-contained story. Well, I mean, which I hope will run into a second miniseries. I don't know. Is there a plan for that? Or
We hope so, yeah. It all depends on whether, you know, whether this one sells. The hope.
Yeah, and it would make a great trade. And Dark Horse do well by their trades, don't they? I think, yeah. You know.
And we do thoroughly recommend our listeners, whether you get them digitally or whether, you know, you see it in your local comic book shop, pick it up and you'll immediately see why you should get it. Because it's a great book.
It's great, superb.
Fantastic.
Yeah, really good. Yeah.
Thank you, lads. I really appreciate that.
I mean, that's coming from a 38-year-old man, you know, me.
Is that your age this week, Penny?
It is, yeah. Yeah. Right, okay. And, a book about a teenage girl who becomes King Arthur, it probably shouldn't be for me, but it's so well made that I loved it, absolutely loved it. Yeah.
If you ever need anyone
to play Merlin in the movie, I'm right up for it as well, by the way.
I would love that.
When it's a good story and a good comic, it doesn't have to be aimed at anyone. It's just what it is, and it's good, and you can enjoy it.
Yeah. That's going back to that question about, you know, the female protagonists and stuff. That's kind of one of the things that drives me a little bit mental. You know, like I don't really care, you know, if it's a boy or a girl. I just kind of want it to be good, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
And it just so happens, like, I'm a big fan of women, you know what I mean? I think they're kind of cool. And they approach things in ways that I don't. And so now I've forgotten what bloody hell I'm talking about. I'm on whiskey number 7 now.
So it's just about making that good story, and whether it's got a female lead or a male lead is almost irrelevant, as long as it's telling a good story.
Yeah. Was there any point during the making of this comic where your wife came in the bathroom and you had a pair of wife fronts on your head, and she said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm just modelling for this panel." Did that happen at all, Nick?
Listen. You actually don't realise how on the money you are. I'm gonna send you some photographs. Seriously.
Oh, superb. I've been meaning to ask that question for the whole episode. You'd had just enough of whiskey there for me to ask it.
Yeah.
Ideal. Yep. Yeah. Oh, the answer is yes.
I think that's the perfect time to finish the talk about the comic. How many of our guests do you think wear pants on their head?
Quite a few, I imagine.
Mm. Yeah.
We do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like that scene in Weird Science. It's
agreed.
Yeah, so go out and pick up a Once and Future Queen, because it's ace, folks. So there you go. And
thank you.
Yes, that's all right. Stick with us, Nick. Does anyone here have any shout-outs?
Yeah, shall I go?
Go.
Big one. Leamington Spa Comic Con, which is on the 25th of this month, March, and at the Royal Spa Centre. Come along. We've got a table. We should have some stuff to sell. I'm hoping that we're going to have some. We're either going to have Daniel Butcher himself, or we're going to have some of Daniel Butcher's stuff to sell. That's the plan, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah. One or both will be there.
Good. Yeah.
And we're talking about like comic book stuff, not a shoe or something like that.
Yeah. You know? Some old DVDs. Yeah. I've got some if you want to bring them along, but yeah.
I'll bring some cassettes along. I've done some mixtapes just for you two, so I'm good.
ACP mood tape.
It's just me talking into a microphone.
Oh dear, certainly puts me in a mood. Anyway,
yeah. I think we're doing a panel. We've yet to sort it out yet with Dan. So we'll see what we're doing.
It's gonna be a cracking day. I'd also like
to reach out, mate.
It's gonna be a cracking day. We're gonna try and get some interviews. We've actually got a sort of plan for our interviews on the day, haven't we?
Which involved me wearing a robe at one point, but we're getting there.
Yeah, yeah. That's fine. Nick wears pants on his head, so it doesn't matter.
And a big shout out to Stuart McCune, not the first Kickstarter we're about to mention, I believe,
no.
For the Beings, which has successfully passed its amount within, I think, a day or two, actually. And good on everyone for getting behind that. I certainly have. Very good. And you've got a Kickstarter to mention as well, Dan, haven't you?
Indeed, yeah. John Late. And he's kickstarted Brethren Born issue 3.
He's made £1 million in the first 2 days, isn't he? I think.
It's just shy of $1 million. But seriously, he just absolutely destroyed the target. I mean, when you've got, as we mentioned before, if you've got a good comic, good product, John
approaches
knows
well. John, both of our friends do, but John does as well. You know, and he did a little lead up to it. You know, it's going live in 3 hours.
Yeah,
it's going live in 2 hours, which I thought was a really interesting approach.
Yeah.
There's a couple of people I'd point out and say, look, if you want to really run a really good Kickstarter campaign, check out what these people are doing, and you can't go far wrong. And John and Stuart are both two that I would say check these guys out and see what they're doing, because they know what they're doing and it works.
Yeah. Really good kick, a really good stretch goals as well. I know Stuart puts out a vote, which print do you think I should do? And it, like you were saying there, Nick, it's important to engage people as the process goes on. You know, so it's sort of that you get a big spike at the start of a Kickstarter, but you need to engage people as it goes on, same as you do with a comic series. Mm. And I think that's what they're doing. It's really clever. Yeah.
Cracking. I'd like to set Kickstarter one day.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I imagine it's easy. Yeah.
So I'm doing the art duties on El Marvo, which is still running the Kickstarter, as far as I believe. But I'm not involved in the organisation of that. That's Ben and Luke, and they're doing a fantastic job too. I mean, that's definitely one to check out as well.
Cool.
Before I forget.
Yeah, and I got I've written the foreword to the Slice Quarterly, which is obviously just met its number as well. Got sent through this week. Yeah, and that is looking fucking awesome. Really good. Nice. Yeah, Ken's really pulled the stops out on that one.
Still rewarding when you go onto Kickstarter, the amount of comic projects there.
It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah.
Really good. And people are really bringing them home these days. I'm hoping we've turned that corner where people don't, you know, and people sort of disappear off social media and books don't come out for years. I hope we turn that corner, you know. Yeah. So there's some really good stuff coming out really in a really timely fashion at the moment. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Nice. I just want to give a quick shout out to the Comic House gents and Hellbound Media guys. A Facebook post went out earlier with the cover of, I think it's number 5, which will mark, it will mark the first chapter of the Mandy the Monster Hunter series that I'm doing the artwork on. So
there's going to be a continued awesome comic podcast presence within Comic House.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Is it Gary Erskine, did you say? Sorry.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. It's crazy, like, when you... Because Comic House obviously gets, like, the pros to take on one of the strips, don't they, to do a cover. And when you see, like just a sketched-up character, you know, design that you've done, in all its, like, wonderful glory on this cover, it's amazing to see. Because I'm like anyone out there. Any character design I've ever done, if someone takes the time to draw it, and it's been the same with Red Mask, that makes my day.
It's the best, yeah
it is fantastic. The best.
Yeah.
So, and to see this cover by Gary Erskine of this Mandy the Monster, I mean, it's not my character, but, you know, it's the design for her armour, etc., that I'm using in the strip. And to see that is both wonderful and soul destroying.
I had exactly the same thing when fucking Carlos Esquerra did Big Lad and Moses from Suit and Booted. I was like, oh fuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great, yeah.
It's awesome. And it's fun working on the series, so I'm looking forward to it. So keep an eye out for that. Issue 4 has just come out, hasn't it, I think? So it's not gonna be
okay.
I think 5's at the end of this month, so keep an eye out for that. I'll be shouting more about it online, etc., when it launches properly and you can get your hands on it.
Nice one.
So there you go. Should we get on to some recommendations, chaps?
Okay.
Yeah. Who wants to go first this week?
Shall I go first?
Oh, yeah. Dan, go first.
We had Sam Johnson contact the show with his comic Geek Girl.
I have to
confess, I've seen this one a lot on social media, but I've never actually got around to buying a copy or checking one out. But fortunately, Sam sent through issue 4 of a 4-issue arc, so I'm kind of jumping in literally on the last issue. So let me read out the press release, because Sam does a much better job than I ever could. At the beginning of Ruby Kane's miniseries, mysterious supervillain Lightning Storm came out of nowhere and hospitalized Maine's long-term resident superheroes Neon Girl and Pitbull. And Neon Girl is tasked with new hero on the block, Ruby, aka Geek Girl, with finding and stopping her. Having won her superpowers, inducing glasses on a whim, Ruby didn't really know what she was going to do at first, but now she's been starting to get a grip with things, and now, as Lightning Storm's threat escalates, it's time for Ruby to deliver, whether she's ready or not. So yes, it's fantastic sort of old-school superhero fun. It's got really nice artwork. You can go and check out all the comics, including issues 1 to 3 with new variant covers, and 4 at geekgirlcomics.com, and they're all on Comixology as well, so you can check them out there. And cool. Give them a go. Good fun read.
Nice, lovely, Jubbly. Shall I go next?
Okay, dude. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, crazy. bits of mixing up. I love it. We're like DJs. Yeah, Matt. Wonderful, massive. Anyway, my pick for this week is that time of the night. I've gone a bit mad. And I haven't had any whiskey. So, my pick for this week.
Please.
I revisited a webcomic, which was Eimurian Tales by Mark Penman, who was with Nick at Manchester this very weekend. Mark's a top guy. And. Like I say, I've mentioned the strip on the show before, because I originally, when I talked about it, it was during its first arc, which was titled The Waterbringer, which he released at Thought Bubble a couple of years ago. That's a wonderful sort of action-packed story. It's a fantasy tale, and it's about a princess and her enormous bodyguard. That one was full of awesome action set pieces and sort of dynamic storytelling, and I loved it, and I've got the book in my hands as we speak. And it's amazing, its quality. It's a good 80-page sort of self-contained story. But what Mark's doing with Eimurian Tales, he wanted to build up a sort of fantasy world, but rather than tell it in one sort of massive story, he's planning to do lots of smaller stories about different characters, and it will all come together to build up the world, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So The Waterbringer was this massive sort of action tale, and he's just started... Well, he's not just started, because it's well underway. And it's a new story entitled The Shattered, which is more about a character who's suffers from an abusive father because of something in the past, which I won't spoil for you. And he basically gets beaten up on a daily basis. And he runs away from his father. And the first page, in massive letters, says, "Oi, come back here, you little shite," which was both dramatic and made me laugh. I don't know why. You don't normally see that straight away.
I like the word shite. It's better than shit, isn't it? Shite is good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this character runs into the forest just to hide away and gather his thoughts. And then a creature appears out of nowhere from this portal. And it's a creature that doesn't normally appear in this land that much. And there's a lot of mystery going on. And it's certainly going to tie back in. There is a bit of action in it. This one seems to be it's a lot more character led, and that's not to say The Waterbringer wasn't, because that's a top book. I love that book. But this one's almost slower paced. It doesn't start off with a massive fight sequence. It's a lot more emotion, and because he's dealing with subjects that are a little sort of darker, you could say in tone, it's handled very differently. And Mark's got a wonderful sort of pacing. His style has a very sort of there's certain influences like that that come into it. Certainly when there's set pieces, and if someone swings an arm, you really get the feeling of that motion, or if someone just absolutely gets their head pounded in, you feel it. But he's dealing with a different kind of style here, and it's brilliant book. There's already 27 pages have already gone by. When I decided to go back, I thought, oh, I'll see if he started the Eimurian Tales again, because he, after the first book, which was an 80 page story, it's not like a 20 page thing, he's doing proper solid tales here. He got picked up for other comic work, covers, and he's come back to this one. And this already, I love the fact, at first I wasn't sure, because it was a different story, I was like, how am I going to get into this one? But within two pages, you're immediately in the world, and you're fascinated by it. And I love it. It's one of my favourite sort of webcomic series, and I definitely recommend you check it out. So it's eimuriantales.co.uk, which is spelt eimuriantales.co.uk. Follow Mark on Twitter at @m_d_penman, because he does cracking work anyway. I remember I met him first when I picked up one of his books, Peabody and Degorath, which was a sort of funny little buddy sort of Lovecraftian tale about a guy that was a skull with a skull for a face who partners up with a demon style fella. I've forgotten who that was published by now, but I've got a couple of prints on that. I love Mark Starr, and he's a great bloke, so check this out. I know certainly when I was at Thought Bubble, old Dan Charnley, our good friend Dan Charnley, he picked up Aimuri and Tales when he was at that Thought Bubble, and I know he was taken by it. So as soon as you see Mark's work, you're going to love it. So there you go, that's my recommendation.
Oh, cool. We must really get Dan on one day, because I know we've done an interview with him, but he's hilarious as well to talk to, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, good company.
Yeah. I'd love to have Mark on the show as well. Mark Penland.
Yeah, he's a
proper good bloke.
Mark is a true gent.
Yeah.
Is he? Right.
Yeah, he's a great, great, great guy.
Yeah. He also has a collection of swords.
Is he?
From Mark together. So we have to be nice to him.
If you meet Mark in person, it makes perfect sense.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's got a fine.
Was he dressed in armor?
Yeah,
he looks like he ought to be dressed in armor. Let's put it.
So there you go. Who's next, Tony?
Shall I go next? Yeah, I've got two actually. If you don't mind, I'm going to do two. Today I reread Volume 1 of The Goddamned, which is titled Before the Flood. By Jason Aaron and R.M. Gera. Anyone read this?
I've heard of it. No. Is that where that's set in the past, isn't it?
Fuck me, mate. It's about Cain, son of Adam and Eve. Inventor of murder, cursed by God. The closest thing this doomed world has to a savior. This makes The Road or The Walking Dead look like, you know, children's television. It really does.
Oh God, really?
It is. So bleak. I think issue 3 has got, there's like a bit of a flashback to Eden, and even Eve is going, she says something to Adam, she says, fuck you, the snake was more than a man than you dickless coward, you know, and you're like, oh my god.
Well, someone said that to all of us at one time, haven't they, really?
I know. I mean, Jason Aaron and Aaron Gere, I love their stuff. Do you know, has anyone read Scout at all, or?
No, not read that.
Seen bits of it, yeah. It's hardcore.
To me, it's one of the Vertigo titles. It's up there with Preacher, Hellblazer, Swamp Thing, Sandman, Shade the Changing Man. It's just one of the greats from Vertigo, and it is an incredible series, just unflinchingly violent and real.
It's one of those sort of like 60 issues and done, isn't it? And it just gets everything done.
Exactly. And as I understand, I think it's been in development for a while for a series. Yeah. But R.M. Gera, he changes his style a little bit in this, and it's much more Euro-friendly. I'm going to put that as a sort of easy way to describe it. I know it starts off with a kid sort of pissing into a sort of mud pit, and he discovers that he's pissing on Kane, who's lying there sort of having recovered from almost dying. You know, there's virtually nothing that can kill him. He's just sort of undefeatable. He wanders across this just horrible landscape, but the art is just fucking absolutely incredible. Some of the best art you're going to see. It collects the first 5 issues of volume I've got. It's $9.99.
What's the dialogue like in that book? I always wonder about dialogue in sort of like, you know, real historical books like that.
It's not quite new, you know, but they do say fucks and all this sort of thing in it. It harks back to a little bit to a sort of more of a medieval style, but not by much. You know, there's a lot of dialogue in it. It's not one of these sort of wanders across an alien landscape with nothing much is said. You know, it's not really that sort of thing. But it's very well done, just incredible. And the other one I wanted to talk about was Knock Off Wars from our friend Lucas Kowalczyk. He's done allegedly, if you believe the credits. I don't believe Lucas. I think he's just playing games again because he likes that. But it's written by Luke Toywalker. That's clearly with art by Lucas. I like crazy shit, and I think everyone knows that. But this is definitely fucking out there. It's just the sort of violent, nutty, white hot heat of crazy amphetamine driven action. It's just non-stop. What he does is, but it's done like as all of his stuff is. Completely tongue-in-cheek, you know, it's painfully funny but done totally seriously, if you see what I'm saying. What they do, he and Luke Toywalker, I had to say, because I'm a little bit too old for Master of the Universe and Thundercats and stuff like that, so I predate the action figure sort of era, so I wasn't really sure. So what he does is he takes he sort of subverts certain action figure styles. So there's Primor, which is a green-skinned Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle looking guy, but with Logan's whiskers. There's Wolf, who's a certain Thundercat feeling about him. Titus is probably, I'm going to say, Panthro from Thundercats. The Archfiend, as they call him in it, is called Disgustor. And they just sort of head off to bash him up, really. I'm not really sure why. It sort of just turns into this sort of huge bash him up thing. It's everything seemed peaceful and quiet on Volcania, homeland of the heroic Turley clan. Turley obviously sounds a bit like Turtle. And this sort of gang of sort of super violent, they all look like action figures, you know, with the sort of funny, weird swinging arms and all this sort of thing, just go at it at each other. Like
permanently grimacing.
Yeah, and there's one picture which is a picture of someone's feet, and there's just piss coming down off his feet. And
piss? Did you say piss?
Piss, yeah. So he sort of pissed himself in the middle of the fight, and, you know, there's a sort of Skeletor character in it. But what he does is clever, because what it is at the end is, basically, right at the end, I don't think ruin it, because it's just a fucking mental bash-em-up thing, they all go in, they don't die, they go to be recycled in the void. So like all sort of plastic figures, like, you know, we're always talking about Funkos, they just become landfill, don't they? Mm. You know, eventually. Most of them, unless you're a bit of a sort of freak like we are, and we sort of hoard things, they just become landfill, don't they? You know, or end up in charity shop dustbins or something like that. It's really good. I like all this stuff. It's got a certain flavour to it. I don't think it's perhaps for everyone, but it's just full on, just hilarious violence. People are pulling out each other, pulling each other's arms off. Pulling their sort of entrails out of their stomachs, ripping each other in half, and all this sort of thing. Very bloody, very gory. If you go to underworldmuscle.storeenvy.com, or if you go follow Lucas on LUKKOW83, it's only $2, and it's really good. And it's got this sort of the last few pages are sort of homages. You know how people redo action figures; they repaint them into something else.
Yeah.
They've done a bit of that on the last few pages, which is always a bit of fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
Highly recommended. Like his Reckless Wrestlers, which I think he's done 4 or 5 issues of now, which I can recommend as well. It's just been crazy shit mad stuff. But yeah, have a look at that. That's my one.
Nice. What have you got, Nick?
I decided I should maybe... Well, actually, recently I've been looking back at some of the stuff that really inspired me as a kid, and one of the biggest things that turned my head was a series called Stray Toasters.
I did.
It's a Bill Sienkiewicz,
yeah,
who at the time I believe I was calling him Bing Sienkiewicz.
We're still not sure, are we? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, since the advent of podcasts, you know, I've heard like 100 American pals say Sienkiewicz, so I say Sienkiewicz now. Mm. But this series, I think it came out on, I think it was a Marvel, it was, what was it now? Was it Marvel Epic Comics? It was a 4-issue thing, and I'm not quite sure how to describe it other than it's a Bill Sienkiewicz book. The sort of stuff that he was doing at the time was that, you know, sort of Elektra Assassin stuff where each page was him exploring a different art style practically. So what one page would be fully, you know, inked, penciled and inked stuff, and then the next page would be like, you know, watercolor paintings, and the next page would be something with lots of photocopies and things like that, and things smeared across it. And anyway, the story of Stray Toasters is basically about this this guy called Egon Rustamagic, who's a criminal psychologist, and he's essentially trying to track down the killer of a serial killer. That's the basic idea, it's kind of like a hallucinogenic noir movie. So if one of those old, you know, 40s and 40s noir movies was, you know, made through the lens of LSD, then I think it would basically look like Stray Toasters.
Yeah. you're simplifying the storyline there quite a lot, and it's not complicated, but it's quite a strange one, isn't it? You know, that it's not normal. It's not a normal detective TV series, if you think of it that way, is it? You know.
No, it isn't. I mean, it's the characters. Maybe I shouldn't have picked this one, actually.
No. I love this book. No. I think it's amazing. Yeah.
It's really hard to describe, but like the main character himself is obviously a psychologically twisted person, and his relationships with women get in the way of him being able to understand what's going on. And,
hang on, what's going on here?
Oh.
No, I agree. Sorry, mate, to interrupt. Yeah, no, keep going, sorry.
Anyway, all I can say is if you get to, you know, your comic shop, please try and find copies of Stray Toasters, because it's one of those really eye-opening books that shows you an artist just firing on every cylinder there is to fire upon. He uses every technique in the book to create the most mesmerizing story that I can think of. So there you go. I don't know.
Yeah, I love it. I love his work. I don't think he can be beaten for imagination, can he? Definitely not. Yeah.
I don't think you could sell it any better, to be honest, Nick.
Yeah.
the way you finished that, I think certainly better than most of the shit I say on a weekly basis.
was it Epic put that out? I can't remember now.
Yeah.
I think it was Epic. Right. And then I believe Image did, like, they might have done a collected thing later on, but I got it in, you know, as the individual thing. So,
yeah,
I think
it's
amazing stuff.
Yeah. So there you go.
Cool. Nice one.
So many awesome books talked about this week. You agree?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Everyone sounds so enthusiastic.
Yeah. I'm just looking at Bill Sienkiewicz's Wikipedia page, and I don't think that's a picture of him. I think that's someone else.
Whoops.
Yeah. Is it someone else, folks? There's several different ways that you can tell us whether Wikipedia is right or wrong. They're always right, though, aren't they? It's the internet. No one ever lies on the internet.
Yeah.
Let us know what you thought of the show and what you thought of the comics that we've talked about, if you grab hold of them. Several different ways you can do it. You can email us, awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Likewise, tony.awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Yeah, just send us your love. We're desperate for love. Follow us on Twitter at The Awesome Pod, where we'll just post up any old nonsense, won't we? We didn't do a poll this week, I think.
Oh, no.
I'm sure someone's going to say something about it.
I wanted a poll.
Oh.
I want your polls.
There's a bit of audio I can use as blackmail in the future. go to facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast. Like us there. We love the likes. And also, if you follow this show on a weekly basis, join our group, Awesome Comics Talk. People get involved, start the discussion, keep it going. Or they'll just post up something just wondering if Tony's been crushed by a massive pile of porn.
Yeah.
That is by a colleague of mine, friend of mine. Yeah. Did find that. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Your own friends accuse you of being killed by porn.
My favourite bit of that is I left it for a couple of people to reply before I went, no, I'm okay, I'm safe.
Yeah, nice.
When, you know, they say, like, when you have someone, when you die, a friend comes around to your house and, like, destroys all the pornography or whatever, he bleaks his breath. That's some fucking job for one of Tony's friends.
Jesus. It's probably just firebomb the house.
Hang on. Is that a thing that if you die, someone comes around and...
I think it's like a joke or something.
It's verbally binding agreement, but yeah.
You I charge a friend for coming around to delete your browser history and burn your pornography.
Now that you've said that, I'm gonna get that written up.
Yeah.
Don't go in long box number 4 to 43 upon my death. Give them to Dan Butcher.
They'll find a welcome home.
I bet there's got to be a market for old porn, isn't there, somewhere? It can't be. There's got to be in there, really.
I think sometimes they turn up at auction.
Right, okay.
Yeah. How much you get from Dan?
Because I know there used to be a shop in Soho. There used to be a shop in Soho. You could go and buy a porn magazine from the year of your month of your birth and buy it for it, or like a present for your mate or something like that.
Okay,
well, that's nice.
Maybe like a Playboy or something. I think. Yeah.
You want to celebrate that kind of thing, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. See what bushes were like on the year you were born. That's what I think. Yeah.
If you listen to us,
fucking hell, Jesus.
We're thinking about it.
Yeah. Oh my god. Thank you for listening to us, whether it is on the website or some icon. That's got me. So close to the end, and he got me in the end. Awesomecomics.podbean.com. Thank you for listening to us there. If you listen to us on iTunes, leave us a review. It really does help get the word out about the show. And we want more and more people listening to this show, so more and more people buy loads of these cool comics that we talk about.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and I know people have been buying stuff that's been talked about on this show, so there you go.
Yeah, we've even had a couple of publishers interested in some stuff we've talked about on the show, which is really good.
Yes.
Yes.
So thank you everyone for putting the good word out about the books and the show. We truly appreciate it. Thank you for listening, whether it was on the Stitcher Network, on the Podnose Network, and where can people find us online, hopefully not crushed by porn. Tony.
You ruined my line there. I'd say I'm underneath box three of Razzle Reader's Wives. I remember being at a party once and some bloke bought a porn magazine and went, look at this woman. And somebody went, that's my wife, and punched him.
And also, who brings that to a party?
I know, what kind of weird party is that? I think Garth suspected he knew it was his wife sort of thing and wanted to have a tear up.
Yeah, they didn't have any wine. Here you go. Here's a Razzle.
Razzle.
Never read Razzle Reader's Wives on the tube because they can always see it in the mirror behind you, the reflection of which page you're looking at.
I think that it's not just that publication, though, is it? It probably goes for quite a lot of pornographic material.
Yeah, like comics. Yeah. Don't sit next to him. He's reading a comic. I deploy that quite a lot on the busy commuter trains. If you read a comic, people are less likely to sit next to you because I think you're weird.
Really?
Yeah.
Dan just does all his drawing on the train and then just because people know how he looks. Anyway, where can people find you online, Tony?
Ezohyz. Reviews at Down the Tubes, and I'm about to go live, hopefully, at ap2hyc.com/cynicism, which is Sequential Cynicism, the new column I'm writing for them. So I'm hoping that's going to go live this week.
New column and a place to hang your cape.
Yes, that's soon. It. That's the plan. Brilliant. Yeah. Nice one, thank you, mate.
It's going to be a spicy column, that one.
Yeah, it's a little bit... It's in my falling down style, put it that way.
Oh god. Dan, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Vanguard Comic, and you can read Vanguard at vanguardcomic.com.
Nice.
Splendid. You can find me online on Twitter at Jester Diablo. Find out more about my comic at theredmousefrommars.com. And I'm going to just go shield this. If you're in the Bath, Bristol, or anywhere nearby area, I'm trying to put on a screening of a horror movie in a little in a little local cinema in Bath. So, if you
was it the Void?
The Void. The Void, which looks
pretty... I'd never heard of it till you'd mentioned it and looked it up, and looks really good.
Yeah, pretty cool. Awesome, twisted. If you like things like The Thing or John Carpenter films or stuff like that, I think it'll be really good. And I discovered this place called R Screen, which is
Arse.
No, O-U-R, not arse, not arse cream. I discovered some arse cream.
they project a movie onto Kim Kardashian's arse.
Better than the IMAX experience.
Yeah.
IMAX, Jesus. Yeah, but these particular people like small independent films, and they put on screenings in smaller independent cinemas. So if you get enough people to get tickets, the cinema will put on a screening of that particular film. You have to sell like 30 tickets or something like that,
and they'll get to meet you.
And they'll get to meet me and sit in a dark room with me for a couple of hours.
Do you do a little intro? Do you do a little on the stage? Thanks for coming.
I don't think you do, but I will if people want it.
Yeah, that'd be good. I'll come for that reason.
But obviously it's in Bath, and I know, and it's a midweek sort of evening showing, so I'm fully aware that people can't travel or make it. But if you can, love to see you. So I'll put a link I'm gonna be annoying people online about it anyway. So
yeah.
I just annoy people daily. All right. Anyway, enough shilling. Nick, where can people find you online, etc.?
The best place I think is Instagram for me. So if you look for Nick Brokenshire, NickBrokenshire on Instagram. You'll find me. That's kind of my new jam these days. I'm sort of late to the game, really, but I've discovered I really enjoy.
Yeah, you're putting some great stuff out. I'm a follower of yours. Yes,
thank
very good.
You.
Yeah.
Yes. And Twitter, of course. Just look for Nick Brokenshire.
Yeah.
Are you doing any conventions coming up, Nick? Or you got any more signings coming up or anything like that?
I've got a signing at... Oh, bloody hell. What's the name of the place? hang on. Let me just walk over to my calendar. Here we go.
Oh, we've got a mobile guest. Bloody hell.
Here we go. Yeah. Gobsmack Comics in Horsham. Is it Sussex?
What a great name for a comic shop.
Yeah, it's out. Yeah, on the way to Brighton, that way, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm there on... Oh, bloody hell. Hang on. I'm there on the 18th of this month. So if you're in that area, please come down. I'll be signing comics and probably sketching and all that.
Nice one. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be at the Lakes Bash, and I'll be at the at Thought Bubble. You know, the big ones, obviously. And so on and so forth.
You do the lakes much? How do you find the lakes? Well, I've not done the lakes yet. I don't know.
It's brilliant. Right. The lakes is a lovely experience because it's basically... because it's in Kendal, this beautiful little town in the Lake District. The whole experience is just completely delightful. So, like, you get there... And the town is gorgeous, and the town kind of gets behind it, and you'll see loads of comic stuff in all the shops. And then at night, you know, the nightlife is really lovely because it's quite localized, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, my band is playing on one of the nights of all.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you about your music. Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah. We play sort of dorky, geeky stuff like, you know, Back to the Future music and Star Wars music.
Awesome.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, like, we did it last year, and we're doing it again this year. But it's a great, great, great convention, and you get really up close and personal with, you know, some pretty astounding creators, in a way that you don't normally get. Like, you know, if you go to, say, Thought Bubble, you know, you've got there's just so many people around, and you've got like the big key. Whereas in the lakes, you can just, you know, walk up to them and hang out. It's really good.
Cool.
Oh, cool.
Awesome. Well worth. Yeah, you can go and hang out with Nick Brokenshire, which we'll no doubt do one day as well in the future.
Sounds like
a bit of a threat when I say that. But yeah, thank you very much for joining us this week, Nick. The book's great, and it's going to do gangbusters.
Thank you.
Yeah, and our listeners will love it.
Yeah, they do well.
Thanks for having me on, chaps. I'm a really big fan of the show, so it's a
thanks, man.
Thrill. Oh, that's a total pleasure.
Yeah.
It's our pleasure. And now you know what an absolute mess it is in terms of organisation and how we do things. No, it's been a pleasure, and I hope you enjoyed it out there, folks. As always, read loads of indie comics and beyond in your week. Have a brilliant, safe week. I know the hurricanes are hitting the UK at the moment, so stay safe, stay fruity, read comics, and as always, stay awesome. See ya.
See ya.
See ya.
But it's been an absolute pleasure, Nick.
Cheers, mate. We've been looking forward to this one for ages. Yeah. It's really good.
We'll let you get back to finishing off that bottle of whiskey, you madman.
Incidentally, I'm not joking. I have nearly almost finished the bottle.
Jesus.
Nice one.
So, I don't know what that means. It means I'm an alcoholic, but there you go.